It's a whole change of behavior that COVID has forced upon us to show us that actually these flexible arrangements can work, and actually it's good and it's better.
You're listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for Real Estate Industry, sales professionals, property managers, and leaders. We bring you the best minds in business and real estate to help you list more, sell more, and elevate your results. To download your written action guide from this podcast containing extra tips, links, and shortcuts, visit EliteAgentElevate.com. Now, here is your host, Samantha McLean.
Welcome to another episode of the Elevate Podcast, where we delve into some of the most interesting minds in business and in real estate for the very best tips and strategies for you to implement to elevate your business. I'm Samantha McLean, editor of Elite Agent and host of this week's show. Joining me today is someone who in two decades has turned a small family business into a multi-award-winning industry agency in Sydney and is also an eight-time winner of the REI New South Wales Large Agency of the Year Award. Welcome to the show, Ewan Morton.
Thank you very much.
This is just like we're in the back of a bus chatting, because I think that's where we were last time, having a very interesting conversation on leadership.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to record an episode of the Leadership Diaries, which because of COVID-19, we haven't done for a while. But first of all, like, how's business for you right now?
Business is okay, better than expected. From what we thought could happen when we did our COVID spreadsheet, which I'm sure everybody did one of those, we had planned for carnage. We planned on our sales fees dropping by 50%, our leasing fees dropping by 60%, and the property management dropping by 20%. That was our starting point. And now that we're 2 months into that, things are panning out to be better than expected. The leasing market, for example, we manage a lot of property. So we have 3,700 odd properties across Sydney. So a lot. So the leasing inquiry completely dried up altogether. So that was a bit of a concern, but that's coming back now. So we're back to leasing numbers that we had previously. The rent reductions haven't been as bad as we thought. You know, about 8% of our portfolio is in hardship. So that's manageable. All the people who stopped paying their rent just because they could or because they wanted to get some sort of rent relief, we're starting to move through that. So the arrears is coming back and the sales team's making it. We set ourselves a target, which was basically a break-even target, and we're ahead of that. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, we're actually selling more property this year than we did last year.
Yeah, interesting.
I know, very interesting, very interesting. And so the whole JobKeeper thing is a real pain because 2019 was probably one of the worst years in real estate that I'd ever had.
Yeah.
For a whole bunch of complicated reasons, you know, that we've talked about, you know, in terms of industry and whatever, two elections, the whole bit. So really, I thought it couldn't get much worse and then COVID's turned up, but we're sort of doing better. So we haven't qualified for JobKeeper and we've tried every single calculation that we possibly can to try and make that work. And, you know, we sat there going, well, if the sales team's going at the rate that it's going, then we won't get there. And you sort of think, that's terrible.
That's a good,
But then it's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Is that a terrible thing or is it a good thing to have a business that's not heading towards those levels? So complicated. Yeah.
In the beginning when it was quite tricky, like a lot of property managers, and you just mentioned that your business is based a lot on property management, there were a lot of property managers struggling with those rent reduction conversations. How did you navigate your way through those?
You know, I think it was like a tsunami of emotion is the way I describe it. So the first week was everybody yelling. So opportunism came right out and that suddenly hit the team. They weren't expecting that. And then the next week was everyone crying because the hardship did start. And not only for the tenants, the landlords started to panic because for a lot of people who own rental properties, it's a negatively geared situation. So they're putting money into it anyway, and without a tenant paying rent, it really puts them under pressure, and particularly if they're a partnership and somebody's lost their job. I think that's one of the things that people didn't fully appreciate. They just assumed landlords were rich, which is not the case. They're saving for their future. They're trying to do all the right things and it put them under pressure. So we had them crying, yelling, yelling, crying the whole bit. So for the team to experience that and have to deal with it, it was quite intense. The team did very well, I think. And this is the other challenging thing, is that suddenly we're all working harder. So COVID was all about businesses declining, but they actually were working harder than ever, having to deal with this situation. So we just had to unite, you know, like we had the whole COVID plan where it was like, we'll have to reduce everybody's salaries, but we actually haven't. And we decided not to, because one, everybody was working really hard, and they were doing that because they realized that we were in a crisis and that everybody had to do the bit to get it through. And if we were to knock back their pays, that wasn't going to be culturally or from an equity point of view, very fair. Yeah. So what we did is we decided to navigate that month by month, and so far so good.
That's really good to hear. And now that we're coming out of it, what are some of the lessons that you've learned?
Oh, lots.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of stuff that I don't want to change. And I can feel us, you know, everyone going, oh, let's get back to normal. It's like, no.
No.
So I think this whole working from home business and the flexibility and work-life balance / blend, where we've all learned that just because someone's not in the office doesn't mean they're not doing their job. I do think sometimes it can be management-y, that we need to have everybody, you know, accountable and here and there. Whereas I think we can trust our people more if you give them an outcome that you want. And I think that's what's happened, is we've actually become outcome focused. So we as a business, we've always been that way, but I think we've gone to another level where everybody's been living in their bedrooms or their living rooms and getting the job done fine. So we've learned that. We've also learned traveling around to be with each other is a massive waste of time. And, you know, at times there is still the other learning is you still need to have connection. So you do need to bring people together. Like, I've got a meeting happening tomorrow of our senior property managers, and I want them in the room for this particular one. I want as many as possible in the room, but they don't all have to be like that. So I think we've learned that. Even myself, I know I can start work at 8:30 at home. I haven't been in the traffic. What a nicer way to start the day.
Yeah.
You know, I've taken up yoga, so I can do my yoga and then I can start work. So that's good. We've also learned a lot about productivity in terms of the leasing team. So we've been experimenting with different ways, because what's happened is the leasing inquiry dropped off for about 2 or 3 weeks, but people continue to give notice. So the vacancy's gone. In some of our markets, like the CBD, reported a 14% vacancy.
Wow.
Never in my 25 years in real estate have I seen that. So, you know, all sorts of new problems. So this continually building up list of properties to lease and no tenant. Now, the tenant inquiry has started to come back now. So we're obviously rents have come down and they're leasing, but we've learned different ways. You know, we always had the view that the leasing consultant needed to be out and we needed to have admin support in the office. We've actually turned that on its head. And what we found is you want somebody out showing the tenant the property, but then the leasing consultant actually in the office negotiating and talking to owners and really drilling into applications and stuff actually works better and lifts the productivity up. So that was interesting. That was a turnaround from what we had initially thought. So I can see a structural change in that. And in our leasing a new business team, the way I'm thinking about it is, you know, 50% of leasing and 50% new business. Well, can we now work so we can have 30 to 40% leasing in terms of time, and the other 60%, even 70% can be spent on the new business, so the energy can go into that, meaning that we can lift the amount of new business that we're getting. So that's good. So that was a big thing. I think on the offices, do you need one?
Yeah, that's a big question.
Big question, right? You know, like, I go down to Piedmont on Thursdays and it's actually me and one of the other sales guys. That's it, right? Everybody else is working from home because of COVID, and it actually worked fine. So I think there's a big question over how much office space do you need? And this is not just real estate. I think this is everybody's having this thought. And also, what does that space need to look like? So what's become important? It's different. So you need spaces where people can dock, they can meet, they can collaborate, they can come together as a community, they can park. That's a big issue for us, because the great thing about Piedmont was with COVID, all the parking inspectors disappeared. anyway, last week they were back. So, you know, managing that, you know, so I think that's a big question. We're having big discussions about what do we see the future of that. You know, do you need to be the local office in the local place, or can it be something different? And, you know, lots of things like that.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of different models sort of crop up in the last 12 months. You know, like, you know, I know Kindred opened an office, not an office, but a showroom rather, in a retail shopping centre with virtual reality. Like, I think this whole thing has caused everyone to get very, very creative.
Oh, massively. And, you know, we were really hell-bent on our local locations. Like, that was our thing. That was part of our supper. You know, even over the last years, we've realised too that no one actually came to the office, but they liked the idea we were there, but they weren't coming anyway. So you go, okay, so there's a perception thing that was happening. And then with COVID, it's really demonstrated that you actually don't necessarily physically need to be there. And obviously, you're in the market all the time. So everyone's tools. So we actually moved to a more mobile work. We're on a plan to a more mobile workforce anyway. So everybody with their own laptops, and we're even dual screens at home, all this sort of business. We're thinking about that. You know, iPhones, there's no actual real reason for you to have to go to a desk now to do your work. You can do your work wherever you are.
Yeah.
We were already down there, but COVID has really demonstrated that that can work.
Yeah.
And it's fine. I think it's a better way to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It brings to mind the old David Thodey, work is something you do, not somewhere you go.
Yes. Yeah. And in the old days, like, right, so a bit older, you had to go to your desk because you had your computer there that was linked to it. It didn't move. So you had to go. And so you would go out of the office and then you come back to the office to do your work because that's where your tools were.
Yeah.
It's really over the last 20 years, it's gone more and more mobile. But I think there's a mindset shift that we've all had to make, particularly for Gen Xers.
Yeah.
Right, where we were raised.
You mean us.
Yeah. Well, you know, you get to the office at 8, you work till 6, you need to be there. Whereas I've actually found even for myself that it's like, hold on a minute, I need to be out there. And it's like, well, actually, no, you don't. So it's a whole change of behavior that COVID has forced upon us to show us that actually these flexible arrangements can work. And actually, it's good and it's better.
Yeah. It's weird though, you know, like, because I come from that era, you know, like, as well, which I just confessed to again. You know, like, my ideal working hours are like 5 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Yeah.
But still, I'll still get up at 5 a.m. and start work, like with the brief and stuff like that. But then I'll get to 3 p.m. and feel guilty for knocking off. I don't know why.
Well,
you know, that's the Gen X thing.
That's it. It's the guilt of the Gen X. Yeah.
Interesting. So we've talked a little bit about your business, but just for people that maybe interstaters that aren't familiar with Morton & Morton, can you give us a bit of a rundown? Like, how did you get into real estate in the first place?
Well, now when I look back at it, it seems like I don't know what I was thinking, to be honest, as in what I thought and then how it panned out was two very different things. I went to university, I got an economics degree, and then I went to work for IBM and I did their graduate training program, which was back in the days where they indulged people in those programs.
That was hard to get into too.
Yeah, it was hard to get into. Again, I didn't really think too much about it, but I'm now very, very grateful for it. What I learned there about discipline and about culture was proven to be invaluable. And also, you know, stuff like, you know, how to behave like a professional. Mm. You know, we used to do role play in IBM, and the people who were in that course, they were well-educated, smart people. And again, it was a bit old school, but people used to get crushed in that. So, you know, when everyone talks about not wanting to do role play because it's intimidating, having been through IBM, I'm like, honestly, now this is back in the late 80s, and I'm going, you are also soft. Like, honestly, because what IBM's view was, they put you through every worst case scenario you can imagine. And the whole idea was when you actually got released to the customer, you can do it. And I can remember my first week where I actually got back to the office and I went, is that it? Like, everyone was nice to me. Where I'd spent a year with everybody being really mean to me, but I'd learned how to handle it. So I did that. And then basically I was selling computers. I was on commission. They had corporate target systems where, you know, you sold a certain amount of computers and that affected your salary. They doubled my target the next year.
Classic IT.
Classic IT.
I know it, yeah.
So basically, I had to sell $1 million the first year. I did that. They increased me to $2 million.
Yeah.
I sold 1.95. I'd increased the business by 950. I didn't make my target. I didn't get the increase on my salary. And basically, I was like, this sucks.
That's classic IT too.
I was like, this sucks and I have been used.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so from that, I thought, well, my dad was in real estate and, you know, obviously I also had a thought process about corporate versus family and, you know, what's important. You know, corporate world is a different beast and not always as caring. And I thought, well, if I'm going to put all that energy into something, I might as well do it for the benefit of my family. And I sort of wanted to have a crack and have a go. So Dad and I set up the business with great enthusiasm in 1996, and it turned out to be a massive nightmare. The crux. The first 5 years, I think from 1996 to 2002, I would now, in hindsight, not wish that on my worst enemy in what I learnt, how little I earned and how hard it turned out to be. So it's like anything. I suppose I was 28 at the time or whatever, and I was full of, you know, enthusiasm and, you know, thought this will be easy. Well, I didn't think it would be easy, but it turned out to be much, 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 much harder than I expected. And really, when I got to 2002, I would have said there was a few times there where I went, I've made a massive, massive mistake. I really have. I remember talking to a friend saying, I've made a mistake. Why'd I do this? I think sometimes, obviously, you got to put a stake in the ground. You go, well, I've made a choice to do this. Also, it's very difficult to give up. So that was part of it too, is I can't give up. I've put too much time into it. And also, I couldn't face the admitting the failure. That actually wasn't an option. I remember it's not an option. Failure wasn't an option. So I just needed to pull myself together and refocus. And basically, what I did was I managed to get myself to a salary. Right, a constant salary, and it was something pathetic, like 40 grand a year or something, but I thought that was a big step.
Mm-hmm.
I also realized too that, you know, all those small business statistics that say that, you know, is it like 80% of businesses are done within 5 years?
But they just don't know it.
Until, yeah. And I remember thinking at the time, someone fed all that stats to me when I got started, and I thought, oh, no, I'll be different. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to the five-year mark, I went, I understand those stats now. Like, I really understand how that happens. So I sort of, it was a bit like, well, I've made this choice. I can't go back. And I decided I needed to learn more. And I'd been actually living in a void. And at that point, I never realized, I don't know why, like I hadn't been a franchise. It didn't occur to me to do that, which now I understand why you would choose to be a franchise, because they've got a system and I just completely in my own bubble. And I realized I needed support and help. So I started looking for organizations to help real estate agents. And it turned out there was quite a few.
Yeah.
And I went to my first conference in 2002, which actually was a best practice, which was back in those days.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
It was Robert Bevan and best practice. And he was really best practice. And Trent McGrath, they had their two principal conferences. So in 1 year, I spent something like 20 grand going to every single conference, study tour. Actually, I went on a study tour when my second child was born, and then I was on the bus a week later, leaving my mother-in-law and wife with the baby. And I thought, well, I'm going off, because I found having children made a big difference to me. I was like, right, I really got to get my act into gear here, and I need to earn money, and I need to pull it together. So, yeah, so I started learning, and from that I realized that a lot of things that I was doing, I was actually reinventing the wheel. I just didn't realize I'd done it. I also realized I was like 20 years behind in terms of, you know, current thinking. So I made it my business. And even today, I make it my business to read stuff and know people and talk to people and ask questions. And I suppose this is for people getting started. People don't mind helping you. They really don't. You know, if you go and ask and say, look, this is my problem, and you ask the question, they will answer the question and they get something out of helping you. Something like, people ask me questions, I give them the answer. And I also decided in all of that, that I would tell the truth.
Mm.
So, you know, I was going to conferences and I'd listen to stuff and I'd write the notes. Like I'm a crazy note taker, and I'd come back to do the implementation plan and I'd implement it and the idea didn't work. So I'm like, oh, what was that about? Have I done it wrong? And then And then I realized what was happening is that people get up on stage and sometimes they do it on purpose. Sometimes they don't. They embellish. They round up. I think that's the best way to describe it. And I realized, oh my God, some of these things actually, you know, someone lied to me. And so what I did then was I thought, okay, get to know people, get a network. So I've got a pretty good network of principals that I can ring up and who you can ring up and actually ask the real question of to find out the real answer. And I found that helped a lot. You know, that took me a few years to get through that because, you know, the next year I went back to the same conference and I was like, no, I'm still behind. The third year I was like, okay, I'm getting somewhere now. I'm catching up with these people. And I think it was the fourth or the fifth I made a speech. So I was like, okay, right, now I'm pulling ahead of it. And I would say like a lot of what we've done is really taking other people's ideas and implementing them better. And from that, you get learnings, which gives you the innovation and the new thing. So that's pretty much my formula.
Interesting. So where do good ideas in your business come from now?
Now it's a bit more complicated because it's not just me. And also my ideas tend to sometimes be a bit stupid. So you've got to create an environment. And it's hard to do this, is create an environment to try and get everybody to participate and put their ideas in. I suppose one of the things, you know, it's interesting, you know, I was down at Green Square yesterday and I'm working with that property management team down there because they've got what I consider to be the right attitude, right? Not to say that the rest of our team doesn't have it. It's just that I wanted to work with a small group because I wanted to affect some change. So I thought, well, I'll start with a small group. And also they've got this curiosity and a desire and an attitude to want to be better, right? And we were talking about that yesterday. I said, well, why? Why? No, you can't really explain it. They just don't want to be crap, right? Even though we may have days which we think that was pretty crap, right? But that's that attitude of wanting to be better. And so I really work on trying to foster that. And from that, being able to help people bring the ideas out and work it. And in some ways, it's harder because such a big part of it now is about the team wanting to embrace the idea. So when I was smaller, I could say, we're doing this, right? And part of, oh God, here we go again. But I could implement quicker and whatever. But as I got larger, I realized I could do that. But actually, the idea would fizzle or not be executed. And also, I've only got one pair of hands. I can't do it all. So I have to try and inspire the people to pick up on the idea or be inspired to solve the problem. So sometimes it's now about going, okay, this is our problem. I have no idea what to do, but it's a problem. What do we all think? So moving forward, I would say that's a lot more about my role is, okay, what's the problem and what do we think can solve it? And then hopefully engage people to want to solve it. And I think that's where it gets more complicated.
That's a really good takeaway there, actually, yeah. Is that you as a leader, you can't do it all yourself, no. Particularly when you've got
Eight.
There you go. That you actually need to work out, rather than how do I do this myself, how do I inspire other people to get the job done for me? That's a really big takeaway there.
Yeah, and I'm a joint managing director. David, who's the other one, he's an investor in the business as well, and he has a different style to me, which in some ways is much better. He's more patient in allowing people, whereas I tend to move much faster. He can sort of create a better environment. And we work to try and get the balance of those two ways in order to inspire people to want to solve the problem and wanting to solve it. Because, I mean, a lot of people, they're like, oh, I don't want to solve a problem. You're the boss.
Yeah.
You solve it.
Yeah. Well, how do you get around that? That is a problem. Like I find a lot of people do want to be told what the solution is rather than thinking of it yourself is difficult.
Well, I was thinking that it's like the empowered piece, right? Everyone talks about the word empowerment. You know, that's a tricky business because if you, you know, say to somebody, I'm going to empower you, right, and you write it down on a piece of paper about what that means, 95% of the people will go, yes, right? Think now I have somebody who's really listening to me and, right, I'm going to empower. But what a lot of people don't realize is what comes with empowerment is responsibility and accountability. And what I find happens is everyone goes to what I call the Duna moment, where you empower. I call it you give them the Shazam. Shazam, right? Done.
I felt and that.
Yeah. Do you feel that? Yeah, it is. You felt that. Right. And they do. They go, oh, my God, I've been Shazam.
Yeah.
And off they go. And then they start to meet obstacle, right? Like what I met. Yeah, anyone. You meet obstacle. They meet obstacle. And, you know, that smashes people and they fall over, right? I call it the road to Damascus, you know, where you've got to stay on the road to Damascus. But for whatever reason, you've been pushed off it all the time. And, you know, you're pushed into the swamp on the side and you crawl your way out of the mud and back you go again, stand up and you take one step and you're in the other side.
Mm.
And it's all about your ability to basically get out of the swamp and keep going on that road to Damascus. So when the empowerment piece comes on, everyone ends up in the swamp. And some people go, you know what? I'm just going to lie here and drown because that's an easier solution. And you know what? I can't really be bothered. The other way I call it is the doona moment. They get under the doona and they say, you know what? I'm just going to lie here. It's nice and toasty and warm. And I don't know, maybe the world will move on without me and I don't need to do it. And the way I said is you've got to, as the leader, you need to stand with them, right? And say, get out.
Give me the doona.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I was about to say get under the doona too, but you can't do that now. That's inappropriate. No. But you do. You've got to rip the doona off and say, come on, you can do it. I will stand with you. Let's go together.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's the key bit that people miss, like from a leadership point of view, is I know this is difficult. I know you don't want, well, you do want to do it, but you don't want to do it. But if we get through this moment, you are going to be better skilled and you're going to be able to have the power to make your own decisions and you'll be in charge and in control. And so what I find is you stand with them and you help them. And then they, if you do it right, they then start to go, yeah, okay, right. And this is sort of part of the retention piece too, because I think there'd be, I mean, a lot of my people will complain about the responsibility that they've got, but I think they'll be hard pressed to find other agencies that give them as much. Or let them have the latitude or do whatever. And once you get used to that, it's very intoxicating, right? It's a great way to work, right? And again, as the principal, you've got to have the right balance between failure and success and learning and all these sorts of things. And, you know, we struggle at that. You know, at times we're good at it, sometimes we're bad at it. But if you continue to work on it, I think that's the way forward. So you end up with a truly empowered model. Where people are really stepping into it. And particularly in times like this, it's a natural reaction to step away from it and not be empowered. So it's interesting where everyone's talking about the empowered leadership model is what's needed. And everyone goes, yeah, yeah, that's what you want. But there's a moment there where everyone goes, no, I'm going to give it back. And you and I always say, so I've already Shazammed you.
Yep.
You can't actually reverse a Shazam.
No, you can't.
No, I can't.
But what happens when you empower people and they come up with ideas that you don't like as a leader or that you think suck as far as the business is concerned?
Good point.
Because it would happen all the time.
No, well, the first thing you say is, does it suck?
Yeah.
You know, we're all surrounded by our own ego, me included, right? And I've got 25 years of experience. And we're doing we're actually doing something right now where our senior PMs are taking a stronger and stronger role in the business.
Yeah.
Like they're linchpins to our business and we're empowering them. And they actually came back to me recently with a culture plan, right? And initially, you know, you do get prickly about that. What? You know, and then I read the document and part of it was I thought there was issues in there that I had dealt with many times. And here we go again. Right. There was other stuff in there that was excellent. Right. The document itself was superb. So what they'd done is they took a long time to do it. And I said, oh, come on, you know, can you snap to it? But they actually took their time. And when I looked at it, they'd actually identified a problem, what the state of play was now, what they thought the solution was. Now, some of those solutions, I went, that's a great idea. Some of it I didn't agree with. Some of it I thought required more debate because they were looking at it from one perspective and they needed to see the other perspective. And what I also realized too is I needed to have a method to make sure they could take all my experience and Betty, who runs our team, all our experience. But we need to be able to give them that experience, not that you must do this. They need to put that into their thinking. And if you get that mix right, that's where creativity comes from. And it's interesting, you know, because we did our first meeting by Zoom to discuss this. And I don't know, it was sort of all right. It started a conversation is what we all decided. I actually think the senior PMs probably handled themselves better than the management team did, because we were a bit sort of edgy about it. But we got through it, and we're doing the next meeting, and I've said, okay, we want everybody in person as much as possible. Some of it will be by Zoom, some not. But we're going the next round of that. And David, who's my joint managing director with me, he's going to chair it, and he's got more corporate experience. And so when I looked at the document they'd produced, it was by far beyond my expectations. And in fact, I had a proud moment where I thought, oh my God, these guys have really thought this through to a much deeper level than I'd expected. And it was great. And so it would be stupid of me and foolish and unempowered and poor leadership if I am not to embrace that and to help them bring some of those ideas to the fruition, because I actually want them to be more empowered than they are. And what they were basically saying is, well, if you want to empower us, well, there's some things that are you doing that are empowering, but there's other things that you're doing that are not empowering. They're controlling. And I'm like, fair point. So we have to have debates, though, because we have to have debates around about empowerment and responsibility and accountability and how we make that work and trust and all these sorts of things. But what we've realized is that leadership structure we've got now is working fine at 3,700 managements. And we think, you know what? It'll probably work okay for 4,500, right? And we can see 4,500. So this time next year, I reckon we'll be there, but it's not going to work at 10,000. And we have ambitions to go to that just because, right? Just have a crack. And so that leadership structure is not going to work. So this work that we're doing now is laying the foundations for what that might look like. So it's pretty exciting stuff. But I have to deal with my own, I don't know, emotion, my own bias, my own preconceived ideas. And also maybe I'm a bit old fashioned and it's time to listen to the young people.
It's a hard thing to do.
It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, really hard.
The hardest thing I reckon that's the hardest thing with leadership is everybody being able to deal with their own ego and get outside themselves. Even the people who are like, I don't consider myself an egotistical person. Like I'm not a thing, but we all have ego around us. And that's the thing that gets in the way of good leadership. And our industry is filled with quite a lot of ego. Yeah, but if we're going to improve as leaders, then we've got to get past that.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, we were talking just before we hit the record button about how you've been going around to all the offices just to be there, you know, for the team during the COVID period. What is one characteristic you think leaders really need in the real estate industry right now?
I think part of it is be there. Like I'm going to the offices and I think that's for them and for me, right? So what I recognized in myself was that I'm not very good in the sitting room. Because we're in a crisis, I felt like I needed to be with the people. And that made me feel like I was dealing with the crisis better if I'm with the people, even if I'm sitting in the office by myself, which happened in one case. We have a crow's nest. I'm there on my own, right? But I felt like I was more there. But I think that particularly in times of crisis, the people need to see the leader, right? And they need reassurance and in some cases, comfort. In some cases, no, you're on the right track, or, yeah, you know what? This is bad. And yes, I know you're going to have to work to midnight, but there's no choice at the moment. We've just got to get through, but I really appreciate what you're doing. So just that encouragement to keep going, really.
Yeah, absolutely. What sort of advice would you give someone going into leadership for the first time in real estate?
Firstly, make sure it's what you really want and really think hard about it, because leadership is actually about being able to think of the best interests of somebody else that is not you. So if you are truly serious about being a leader, you need to deal with that question first. If you're going into leadership because, and again, this is one of the quiet conversations you have with yourself in the back of a cupboard, is it because you'd like the prestige or you'd like the power of being able to boss people around or tell them what to do, you know, being able to tell the receptionist to go and get your cup of coffee? If that is fulfilling some sort of need that you've got for your own self-importance, if that's what you're thinking you're going to get, then do not do it. Stay doing what you're doing, because A lot of people think leadership does come... Well, actually, you know what? They used to think about leadership came with some privilege, like you got the car space or you got the glorious office at the top of the thing. It's all gone now, right? It's all about authentic leadership where you need to be humble and you have to actually genuinely be that sort of person. You've got to be somebody who will sit at the crappers desk, that you'll turn up and front the auction that's going to be a disaster, you know, all of these types of things. So you have to be a... have to have a certain givingness to you as a natural trait. And it's interesting because those traits are not always what makes the best salesperson. You might be out there as a salesperson that actually, I don't know, you're doing okay, but...
You decide you want a better commission split.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. Or something like that. There's two different types of people, right? So I think you have to decide first which type of person that you are. Right, and where you want to go. Like, I've had times where I thought, oh, bloody stuff, you all, I'll go back and sell real estate. But I always end up back in the leadership situation. I always step into it, right? Whether I like it or not, I just naturally do that. I cannot help it. I cannot help but be in a group and somehow emerge in the leadership style of it. It's part of who I am, really, and what happens. So I've embraced that. And thought, well, that's my thing. Whereas I've got, you know, one of our top guys, our top sales guy, he's like, man, I couldn't do any of that stuff. I just want to list and sell real estate. And it's like, that's fine. So there's an acceptance there amongst us of what everybody's good at. So I think that's the very first thing. If you go into leadership, you must have that conversation with yourself and go in for the right reasons and realize that your life is about to get worse, yeah. Right? Not better, yeah. Worse. And the reason for the worse is because you are now going to have your success created by other people. So I would say to everyone at Morton, my success is your success. If you fail, I fail, right? So how I succeed and make money is determined on whether you succeed and make money, and that's it. So you don't have direct control over that. You know, so someone decides to come in to work at 9:30 in the morning or not do the phone calls or whatever, you know, when you are completely in control and you're a disciplined person, right, you get in there, you're there at 8 o'clock and you make the calls, right? You're in control. Whereas when you become a leader of it, you're not in control of that. You have to inspire them to do it. You've got to explain to them. You've got to influence them to do it, but you can't make them do it. And that's where the challenge comes. And if you find that frustrating, then don't go into it. So I think a lot of people go into leadership thinking it's going to be something that it very quickly turns out that it's not. And they're not skilled up for it. And you can tell them because they become whingers, right?
Yeah.
When they're, oh, you know, my team this and what, and you go, okay, right, yeah, it's a problem them or you, right? And I think it might be you. So that's how you can tell. And that's where someone needs to, oh, my God, maybe I need to actually be a salesperson, run a team, be a property, like whatever it is, but you need to really think about that because it's a different set of skills.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we wrote a story on your business, I think it was about a year ago, you know, on your approach to culture.
Yes.
Because culture is very important to Morton & Morton. So yeah. A couple of questions on that. First one is, what's your favourite question to ask someone in a job interview?
Favourite question.
And how do you know if they're going to be a fit into your culture?
Interesting. I'm a bit old school in terms of my interviewing technique, which we have a people and culture manager now who's always like, you know, and you can't ask that. And I'm like, yes, I can. I always want to know about the background of a person. The thing is, it's not about the skills that they've got. You can teach anybody anything. It's all about attitude and where they're coming from. So I like to get into a conversation with people and I want to understand why have they arrived at where they're at today? What's that about? And that's their family background, you know, mum and dad, what did they do, particularly for young people? And again, they say you're not supposed to ask these questions, but I don't care.
Yeah.
It's like me sitting here talking to you and I'm like, okay, what's making Samantha tick, right? You sitting there's a lot there, where you've come from, where you were educated, what you did, why, your family, your background. So I'm curious about people. So I ask all sorts of questions to really try and firstly, make a connection. So if you ask a lot of questions, it gets a conversation going and you make a connection, then you're engaging them in wanting to be in the business. But also you're trying to work out, is this person got the grit to cope with the complexity that's going to come at them? So that's really what I'm trying to work out. We do psychometric profiling,
yep.
So behavioral stuff. I find what happens is I pour over that stuff and I will re-interview based on what that comes out. So if I create a get a perception of a person and then that profile comes back and it backs up what I've got, it's okay, right, I'm on the wrong track. Sometimes I go, I don't understand that. Like, where did that come from? I will actually want to get them back into interview. This is one of the interesting things is I don't do a lot of the interviewing now. It's now done by others. So one of the things I'm trying to work on is how do I get what I know about interviewing and what I know about this stuff into people so that they can take the same skills away. Whereas I find what happens is we're all biased towards employing people who are like us, right? How do we know it's the right one? We have this thing, it comes down, you do all this testing, all this interviewing. It all comes down to the feeling. We call it the feeling. You just get the feeling. Is this person, and I have it, you may say, someone goes, oh my God, and you could go, okay, I just feel culturally this is the place. And I'm going, it's the feeling, right? So you need to have that on both sides of the fence. Now, we don't always get it and people pretend it. So complicated to see through that, but that's really what I look for when I'm doing it. Like, I'm looking for people who, yeah, they're not necessarily motivated by the money, but of course we all want the money. That's why we work, right? But it's people who are actually motivated by doing the best that they can, that can, you know, look at something and go, yeah, no, that was good, but we can do better. You know, someone who can look at something and go, we did our best, but not get caught up on that, right? Always pursuing wanting to be excellent. And that's the sort of thing that comes and goes in a person and also can be quite exhausting.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I know I'm, like, it's funny, you know, sometimes I think, okay, you know what, I need to clear out right now because everyone's exhausted talking to me, but it's just that relentless push to want to improve and make things better.
Yeah, yeah, well, I think you've got to have that. But, I mean, interesting too about your business, because you are so dialed into the culture of your business, how do you get someone new walking in the door to understand that and be a part of it? Like,
look, culture is a really tricky thing. You know, you get everyone goes, we've got a culture problem. Culture is one of those things that you get right for a moment and then it can turn on a dime. So it's one of those things that I think, firstly, you've got to be ever vigilant, right? So, you know, when I'm having a moment, a quiet moment, or if I'm thinking, I have this, it's like my team actually goes through my head like a slideshow. And I'm thinking about those people all the time as to how are they going? What are they doing? What do they need? What's my impression? What do I perceive? Why do I perceive that? Am I perceiving right or wrong? Have I missed something? Am I seeing behavior that I've seen before? What do they need? I would say my job is to act in the best interests of my people. Even if that means the best interest of that person is actually to leave, then I have to do that. And if it means that they should leave to go to the competition, then I have to be prepared to do that if that's what I think is in their best interests. And also, that has to be a decision that we make together. The key to that is making sure that you're having those conversations with people. You're looking for those moments where things are going off track. Like, culture can change. You don't even know it occurred. The other thing too is culture is not just my responsibility. I'm obviously the captain, so I'm the captain of culture and I need to have an overview of how it's all traveling. But each individual needs to make a decision to participate in the culture. So you have to have some leadership around them making the decision to be part of the culture, because someone can choose not to as well. And often they choose not to and you don't even know they did that. And you get it, like, you know, people can get negative about stuff. You know, I call it the water cooler talking, where they're going, nag.
Yeah.
We try very much to say, you know, everyone's supposed to have the dialogue. Oh, you seem really upset about that. It seems like you've got a real issue. You know, Ewan told me in the induction that if I ever had an issue like that and I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere, I could always go and talk to him. Why don't you try that? No, I don't want to talk to him. Well, it sounds to me like you need to talk to somebody. No, I don't need to. It's all fine. Okay, then why are we talking about this?
That word, fine.
Yeah. It's like, why? Yeah, so it's trying to do that. You know, we do stuff like you're trying to have an induction to set the expectations. Mm. Our seniors, you know, they've this plan they did was called a culture plan, because they're looking at how do we make things better for people. You know, they had a whole thought process too about people who leave, why. You know, they were really asking, what about exit interviews, which we do. But then it was about how do you actually translate the information that comes out of that exit interview in an appropriate manner. But they wanted to know, how do we get this information so we can look at how we can improve and be better? culture, you know, we could talk all day on it because it's such a complicated moving feast. And we have times like where our culture is really great and we have times when culture is really bad. I've had times where whole teams have turned on each other in Facebook and been slagging each other and I just didn't even know that was happening.
How do you deal with that?
Sack people. No. No. Look.
As a leader, like, you know, you've just heard about this. It's like,
well, I think firstly, stay calm, right? Stay calm, ask questions. Work out what's really going on. You know, like you've got to wade into it. In this particular case, it was just basically someone who was behaving very poorly. And I don't always see, like I always say to everybody, everybody lies to me. Like who's going to present their worst face to me? Mm. Right? How's that going to serve their purposes to do? They don't. So they're all nice to me. So often what I see and what others see is completely different. It happens all the time.
Yep.
So one of the things I try and say to people is, don't worry about what I think of you. Worry about what your peer group thinks of you. Because if you decide to suck up to me, which is what people do, but then you're something different to your colleagues, you'll probably create yourself a Lord of the Flies moment where they'll reject you from the island. And that's a worse problem. So, you know, and we see that happen where teams will eject people. And I'm like, oh, I don't know why that happened, but because there's a whole mode of behavior going on below that they got sick of or they won't do. So very complicated. I think the key to it is it comes down to being a giving person in the sense you've got to be thinking about everybody else, genuinely thinking about what's best for them. And by doing that, it's taking you on the journey of what's going on culturally. And if you think, oh, I'm not so sure about that, I have another rule, which is go hard, go fast, go early. So go in there to have the conversation. And I always find if you have someone's best interests at heart and you are coming from a caring place, you can say anything to anybody.
Mm.
So over the years, I've said some stuff that I would have thought people in culture would not be happy with. But from that, because they might be going, you're going past a boundary there, Ewan, but they understand why I'm doing it. It's in their best interest and they will roll with that. And I will get away with it, or I will actually have a deeper conversation with that person, which will hopefully get us towards resolving a situation or getting them to understand something so that we can all move forward. So it's, I don't know if that's a good answer, to be honest.
I actually think there's a good takeaway in that, which is having the intention of caring.
Yes.
And having a straight discussion. Like we've just been talking about that in Transform, actually, with Carolyn Balderston, based on the book. Kim Scott's book, Radical Candor, because you can't just be completely 100% empathetic with people and be a pushover and not get the job done.
Yeah.
You can't be arrogant about it and have the whole thing fall over, but somewhere in the middle there is a spot where you can come from an intention of care, a place of care, and have the straight conversation.
Yeah, and it has to be genuine.
Yeah.
So I think that, I remember going to something, you know, where the theme was authentic leadership. It was it might have been an ARIC where the theme was be authentic. And I was sitting next to a woman who was a scream and she said to me, she goes, oh my God, I haven't been authentic for 25 years. And I said, well, you're being authentic in that.
I think authenticity is overrated too, if that helps.
Yeah.
So, like I think intention's way more powerful.
Oh, massively. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. What is the worst advice you ever heard given to someone in the real estate industry?
The worst advice?
The worst advice.
I think one of the worst, buy the Mercedes, you deserve it.
It's probably up there.
Well, the thing is that I think we're moving past that is that the public don't respect that. And I think that that is part of what's created a lot of the problems in our industry is that very attitude is that you manage to sell a property for a big commission, so therefore you deserve a first-class flight to London. There was a moment in time where that was the trend, you know, in terms of doing it. But I think from a cultural perspective, very, very damaging. And I think that based on what real estate sales is, that's like going the lowest common denominator, where in fact what you should be thinking is, I don't deserve anything. I should just be grateful for what I've got and approach it with a degree of humility, because once you turn to arrogance, I think that means that you're going to start to lose. And there's that whole thing in real estate that the wolf at the bottom of the mountain is hungrier than the wolf at the top. And if arrogance comes in, you're finished because it blinds you. You know, it makes you think that you're somehow special when in fact there's a bunch of people who are willing to take your place. So I think that you need to stay broad to that. Yeah.
Well, that's it. None of us are owed anything, really.
No.
Are
we? No, we deserve nothing. You know, I really think that you deserve nothing.
Yeah.
Right? Yes, you know, work hard, get stuff, but really, you know what? Just be thankful for that. And also, generally, a lot of the success that we have is not actually about us. It's about a whole group of people who are working towards that goal, and we should just be grateful.
Yeah.
So I think the more of that we had in the industry, actually, the nicer it would be as a place to work.
Yeah, absolutely. So where do you see the future of the industry?
It's interesting, you know, because we've obviously been through what I call the age of hysteria, where we were so concerned about disruption and disintermediation, and everybody in Silicon Valley was coming to get us. And those discussions happened 3 or 4 years ago now. And a lot of good stuff's come out of that. I think as an industry, we are talking more to each other. You know, I see some of the principal discussions, which are great, and everyone's able to separate the competitiveness of what we do to industry discussion. And that's a sign that we are maturing.
Yeah.
And if we can have those types of discussions to solve industry problems, then I think that that's a very, very positive sign. So the collaboration that's going on amongst the industry that's breeding and getting stronger is a very, very positive thing for us to be able to protect our industry. So I think that's good, and I think that's going to get better and better. I'm very optimistic about our role. I think technology gives us greater and greater clarity about the value that we add as technology takes away some of the tasks. So I was having a debate, say, in the property management space, you know, when that whole, you know, disintermediation and Silicon Valley's coming for property management, I was just like, bloody hell, you know, that's 25 years worth of work up in smoke, you know, with the rent roll out sort of size. It's like, yeah, right, that's great. And the asset value that sits behind that, if that's diminished, I'm back to the beginning, right? Yeah. So I was absolutely, that was one of those things that made me feel sick, where I thought, bloody hell, you know, here we go. But now that we're moving into that, the value that we offer, it's on the selling and on the renting side, is that we deal with humanity. So I think about all the things that happen in the property management business on a day-to-day basis. As people do people things and create situations that are / stupid, ridiculous, tragic, sad, happy, all of this sort of stuff. And while that's there, there will be a role in us to manage it. And what we need to focus on as an industry is the skills that are required to be that customer person to help people buy and sell real estate or rent real estate or how they do it. And I think if we focus on owning that, we'll be fine. Mm. And I think over the years, we haven't fully appreciated that that's actually what the customer wants us to do. I went to all our landlords and said, well, what do you want from us? In all this disinterest, okay, what do you all want from us? And it was so fascinating to listen to the response of the landlord, which were they like, the first one was like, they looked at me going, I don't know. Could you do your job?
Yep.
I went back to our team. I went, you know what? Forget added value. Right?
Yeah.
Forget all the crap. Whatever we promised on that management agency agreement, let's just do that.
Yeah.
Right? So if we said we're going to review the rent, let's review it. Right? If we're going to, so it's amazing. You go, oh my God, all of this talk. And what do we need to do? Do our job. And what are we doing as an industry? Not doing our job. And there was good reason as to why we weren't. And technology is helping us to be able to do it. But what a blinding flash of the obvious. Oh, forget about Silicon Valley. Just do your job and you'll be fine. And I remember one guy said it to me. He said, you know, he said, what I want you to do is I just want you to collect the rent. In fact, he said, collect the rent, deal with the human crap in an ethical and fair way and leave me out of it. And I think on the selling side, it's the same thing. It's get me the best price. Do it the right way. Like, I think our customers want us to behave in an ethical fashion. And there was a time where there was all sorts of real estate tricks that were done, right? But they're like, no, give me the best price that's available on the day. Do it in a fair way and I'm happy and I'll pay you the money. So I think that as an industry, we lost sight of that a little bit, and that's what we should be concentrating. Let technology deal with the rest of it. As long as we're controlling that human bit we'll be fine. And I always think of the some of those big companies, say, from Silicon Valley, where I call them the fancy pants men. You know, they're all coming up with the fancy idea. They look at what our revenue base is and what we're doing. The only asset class that the management of has not been consolidated, right? What a great opportunity. And you sit there and go, you know what? You've done every MBA in the world. I get it. You've been to university. Fantastic you. But have you ever cleaned up a suicide?
No.
And they look at you blankly. I said, have you ever done that? Right? Have you ever had to actually sit down with a parent for someone who's attempted suicide? Have you ever actually had to deal with a dead body? Right. And they're like, does that happen? And I said, well, in our, like, we have two or three deaths a year in terms of our, it's big enough now for us, that's a human thing.
You had quite a couple of high profile ones too.
Yes, actually, yeah. I wasn't even thinking of those. Yeah. But yes, we've had high profile suicides.
Yeah.
Right. We've had murder. So I said, do you deal with that? Does your technology solution deal with that? I don't think so. Now, it's not to say that, yeah, we all need to be suicide experts, but the thing is that that gives a nature of what we deal with. We deal with the messy side of humankind. And until humankind stops doing that, there will always be a role. If you look at all those studies that come out, say, which professions are going to get finished off, doctors and lawyers are well in front of us. Real estate, still they're going, no, they'll be fine, because we deal with messy human emotion. So and we should step into that and embrace that. And that's my strategy for the future, is to make sure that my guys are absolutely skilled up to be able to deal with those and have the time and the space to deal with the messy situation. And that's the value that we add.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, if I could make one prediction, I think COVID-19's only amplified that.
Mm.
Because at the moment, if I was the landlord, I wouldn't want to be dealing with all the messy stuff of hand sanitizer and rent reductions and, you know, like, I think, if anything, this last 8 weeks has actually amplified how valuable a good property manager or a good agent really is.
Every real estate agent is well versed with human nature.
Mm.
And we've all seen superb examples of human nature. And we've also seen people under pressure demonstrate poor examples of human nature. And we have skills, negotiation skills, customer service skills, to be able to handle that to get good outcomes for our clients. And I think if we recognize that, don't worry about the technology and the disruptors and all that sort of stuff. Focus on that bit and you'll be completely fine. And you know what? People might actually pay us a premium for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ewan, it has been absolutely fantastic to have you in the studio today. It's been a long time coming, actually.
Yeah, and anytime.
And I'd like to thank you for sharing some of your experiences with us today. If there was one thing that you'd like to leave the audience with, what would it be?
My fundamental philosophy that underpins all the crap that I've been saying is that if you wake up in the morning and you're breathing, then you might as well get out there and do your best. The worst case scenario is that you will learn something. That's it. The best case, obviously, is that you'll be a success, grow in income, grow in knowledge, all that sort of stuff. So that's how I approach my business. That's how I approach life. And I think that's the trick.
Yeah, absolutely. And be a good human.
Be a good human.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you don't take the Porsche Cayenne with you. That's a funny one. I always say to part of, we do our own leadership training. So I do that. And one of the things I say to everybody is, you know, what would people say to you at your funeral? Like, what do you think they would say? And I always say to the young people, don't worry, because you're young, a lot of people will turn up. They always turn up for a young person's funeral. The older you get, the attendance drops off. And you really need to think about that. You know, my whole thing is about contribution to other people. If you make contribution and help other people, that's much better than anything that you can ever earn. And it leaves a legacy. So, you know, that's what I think. And, you know, what do we do in real estate, really? Like, we cloud it, you know, money, all this. No, we don't. We help people. That's it. We help people. And if you take that view, then real estate's a fantastic place to work.
Yeah, absolutely. That is great advice. Ewan Morton, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Elevate from Elite Agent. To download your written action guide from this podcast containing extra tips, links and shortcuts, visit eliteagentelevate.com.